This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The economic relationship between America and China.
A high-level source says there's room for improvement.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Friday, April 27th.
Coming up, what to do with public money that's just sitting around.
A conversation with Virgin Group's CEO, Sir Richard Branson.
Plus, the Los Angeles riots 20 years later.
It's all coming up on a special edition of the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner are bound for high-level talks in Beijing next week. Ahead of those meetings, Geithner welcomed the recent move by China to let the value of its currency float within a wider range, but said the yuan should be allowed to go up more against the dollar. That would make Chinese goods more expensive to sell here in the U.S. and American goods easier to sell there. In an interview, Marketplace host Kai Rizdal asked Geithner about the relationship between the two countries.
You're about to make your, 15th, 20th trip to China in the past 4 years. You spent a lot of time on an issue. I'd be curious as to your take on the state of our economic relationship.
Better than it was.
Is it good?
I think it's better than it was. Exports have grown, are growing very rapidly. It's a good test. Their exchange rate has appreciated against the dollar, about 13% in real terms over the last 20 months. That's pretty good for us. It means the competitive playing field is moving in our direction. There's better protection for intellectual property rights in China, less piracy against U.S. firms. And we've been very aggressive in using the protections in U.S. trade law to challenge unfair trade practices in China.
Well, Kai and Secretary Geithner also touched on Europe. There was news today that Spain's credit rating has been downgraded again by Standard & Poor's and new figures that show the country's unemployment rate is now 24%. Kai asked Secretary Geithner how worried he is about Europe.
I feel relatively comfortable, and the Fed feels relatively comfortable, that we're in a much better position to withstand the pressures, uncertainty we might face from Europe still. But again, it's important to acknowledge that Europe is a big part of the global economy, and if they were to systematically mismanage their crisis, it would have a material impact on growth, like it did in 2010.
Yeah, 11. Well, yeah, exactly.
I don't think that's necessary. I don't think it's likely, and I think they've made a lot of progress the last few months in trying to bring back a measure of calm to their financial markets.
You saying you're relatively comfortable is not incredibly reassuring.
Well, I'll say it more strongly then. The U.S. financial system is in a very strong position to withstand the foreseeable pressures we might face from Europe.
You can hear the full interview with Treasury Secretary Geithner on Friday's edition of Marketplace. And later on this podcast, we'll be talking with Marketplace producer Megan Larson, who was with Kai for that interview.
Now to some other news. In Philadelphia today, there's a conference to urge state and local governments to start public banks. A public bank could invest idle taxpayer dollars like public employee pension money or government rainy day funds into the local economy. Mortgages, student loans, neighborhood parks, and infrastructure projects. After the financial crisis, public bank supporters say it's an idea whose time has come. But just what is the idea? Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story.
As someone who didn't know anything about public banks, I told the Public Banking Institute's Michael Krauss that he has a semantic problem. A public bank sounds like a government takeover, and he agreed.
If you call it public banking, automatically you get red flags. In Washington State, they call it the Washington Investment Trust. They don't use the word state, and they don't use the word bank in their legislation.
Whatever you call it, Krauss says local governments are beginning to realize they can put pools of taxpayer money to work in the community instead of sending it to Wall Street.
In many states, the money goes off to Bank of America or Morgan Stanley, and they never see it again. It gets loaned into other businesses, other countries, other enterprises. It doesn't come back to that state.
North Dakota has run a successful state public bank that's been backing local infrastructure projects for 90 years. Chicago just created the first city infrastructure trust, and 17 state legislatures are considering bills to either start or study their own public banks. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The big news about company profits this week has been spelled APPLE for a good part of the week. But do not forget Samsung, which reported record profits of its own today. Samsung makes a lot of things, of course, but its smartphones are doing especially well. Marketplace's Queena Kim reports.
Everybody knows the iPhone, but can you name Samsung's phones? There's the Galaxy, and then the Rugby, Focus, Infuse, Captivate, and Indulge.
You probably look at a portfolio that goes between 10 and 15 products a year.
That's Carolina Milanisa, a consumer products analyst at Gartner.
They have different price points, they have different designs, and they segment the user base in a more granular way than Apple does.
And that appeals to carriers like AT&T and Verizon, who worried about being too dependent on the iPhone and in the grip of Apple. Carriers typically subsidize the cost of your cell phone. For many Samsung phones, that cost runs about $100 to $200. But for the iPhone, it's a lot higher. Scott Sutherland is a telecom analyst with Wedbush.
Apple gets about $600 per device, and carriers sell those devices for about $200. So the larger subsidy obviously hits their bottom line.
With its diverse offerings, Samsung could give carriers more control over that bottom line. I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Well, we heard a bit from Secretary Tim Geithner a moment ago. Now we're going to hear from another big player in the global economy, billionaire businessman Sir Richard Branson, the chairman of Virgin Group. He was in Washington yesterday for a forum hosted by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on how businesses can help solve the world's problems.
After he spoke at that summit, Branson sat down for an interview with the Marketplace Morning Report. For today's Midday Extra, we have the full interview as it happened.
Sir Richard Branson, chairman of Virgin Group, joins us now from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Well, let's start with what you're doing in Washington. You want to screw business as usual. What do you mean by that?
I wrote a book which is trying to get business leaders all over the world to not just think of how we can make lots of money, which is fine, and not just to think about how our business can make a difference to other people's lives, which is also fine, but to take some of the either major problems of the world or some of the local problems of the world, depending on the size of the business, and get out there and try to tackle them. And I think that if businesses do that, it's particularly with business leaders that have maybe got entrepreneurial skills, that we can help social workers, help politicians get on top of the problems of the world.
Well, what is it that businesses can do that governments cannot do?
I think that business leaders, if you say take myself, I've had 40 years of being an entrepreneur, of looking at entrepreneurial ways of doing things. So, for instance, say 10 years ago decided, okay, why shouldn't we try to build a spaceship, and let's think of find whether we can find engineers who could build a spaceship, and can we build a mother port, and thinking sort of quite big. So when it comes to problems like conflict resolution issues in the world, I would sat back and thought, why do we still have conflicts in the world? Can we just rely on governments to stop conflicts? Maybe people like Nelson Mandela or Kofi Annan or Archbishop Tutu or President Carter or these wonderful ex-statesmen, if we put them together as a group, they could go in and resolve conflicts, and we can run it like we run a business, but with say 12 wonderful men and women, and that's what we did. We formed a group of wonderful elders who go into conflict regions and have managed to knock heads together and stop some conflicts. And so it's just coming up with coming up with ideas which are not just, you know, let's make a lot more money by creating a new business, but, you know, maybe let's set up an organization to tackle conflicts or to tackle global warming or to tackle diseases in Africa.
Just thinking outside the box is what you're saying.
Yeah, I've always tried to avoid the word thinking outside the box. I don't know why, but yes, in a nutshell, trying to come up with a different new approach to things. I mean, you know, with global warming, you know, there are some in America that, you know, do not believe the world has a problem. There are others, you know, around the world who believe that, you know, man is creating a problem with global warming. But, you know, whichever way you believe, it is wise to, as an insurance policy, to try to get on top of the problem of the fact that, you know, oil's running out. We believe the carbon is damaging the world, and therefore, you know, let's work with the 25 sectors and let's set up a carbon war room to try to come up with a way of reducing the carbon output of major companies, but at the same time trying not to damage them as businesses. So, you know, come up with imaginative ways of dealing with the issue.
Well, let me ask you about that, because climate change is obviously one of the issues that's most important to you. But you also run an airline business, which I think some people will look at that and say, well, how can that be? Aren't airlines one of the biggest problems when it comes to climate change?
Airlines certainly pollute, and therefore, through the carbon war room, one of the areas that we've got its top priority is to try to come up with alternative fuels that do not pollute. So, and also all the profits that the Virgin Group take from Virgin America or from Virgin Atlantic or from Virgin Australia, we invest in trying to come up with alternative fuels. So, we've had some major breakthroughs, algae-based fuels, isobutanol-based fuels, and also a way of, turning the rubbish that comes out of aluminium plants and into jet aviation fuels. So I think, turn the clock forward a few years, the aviation industry hopefully will be one of the cleanest industries in the world, rather than a dirty industry.
All the profits that are coming in go to that?
Every penny that the Virgin Group take out of those three airlines, we invest in that area. Now, it's not on a charity basis. I mean, obviously, if we can, if we can be powering our planes with clean fuels, we will have a competitor to jet aviation fuel. We will hopefully not be taxed by countries because we will be running on clean fuels, and therefore, hopefully, the ticket price will be less, and hopefully, more people will travel on us. So, you know, and that's really what Screw Business as Usual is all about. Try to do things for the right reasons. But also try to make sure that you can pay the bills at the end of the year.
Well, but isn't being a jerk a key trait of a lot of business people? I'm not saying that's something that you do, but you're saying people should do things for the right reasons. There are a lot of people who have made a lot of money not thinking that way.
I think being a business leader that treads all over people and to get to the top, the sort of stereotype of a business leader, is actually not the way to become a successful business leader. I think if you run your business fairly, if you treat people well, if you try to move your business into areas that are making a real positive difference to other people's lives, I think you'll A, have a much more pleasant life, but B, I think you'll have a much more successful business. And I think if the people who work for a business are proud of the business they work for, they'll work that much harder, and therefore I think turning your business into a real force for good is good business sense as well.
I want to ask you about something that you're involved with. You run a private train network in the United Kingdom, and in this country, people have had so much trouble trying to get the train system to operate profitably, or at least not with a huge public subsidy. How do you do that? How do you make money with trains? And are you willing to come over here and start a private network in the U.S.?
If invited, we'd love to come to the U.S. and see if we can help on the rail front. And we have looked at, you know, like Los Angeles to Vegas and, Miami to the Keys and one or two other places. So, so we will explore ideas. But basically, you know, the way we, I think, transformed a chunk of Britain's rail network was, you know, we took over rundown, nationally run rail, you know, piece of rail that, up the west coast of Britain. We put brand new trains on it. We got staff working in those trains that loved their job and were proud of the difference they were making. And we've doubled the number of passengers in the last 6 years, from 15 million people travelling on the trains to 32 million. And, you know, I think we'll get up to something like 45 million over the next handful of years. So, so if you offer people a decent service, if you give them, you know, internet access, if their phones are not cut off on the trains, if you have plugs where they can put in, you know, plug in their computers, and if you have a smiling, cheerful staff, and if you can travel really quickly, then you can make a success out of the rail business.
So I guess I shouldn't ask you what you think of Amtrak.
I think it's got a little way to go.
All right, let me ask you this. You do business in both the U.S. and Europe. They're two places with very different economic circumstances right now. Why do you think that is? Is there something different about the people in both places, or what is it?
Both continents suffered from overspending and got themselves into horrible debt. Both continents are doing their best to get out of it. The America has approach has been to try to stimulate the economy, to rescue ailing companies, and it looks like that might be working. Europe have tried a different approach, some countries in Europe have tried a different approach to other countries, but the jury's still out as to whether it's going to work or not. I'm an optimist and hopeful that it will work. But I think some countries in Europe are going to they just got so much debt that it's going to take a few years.
What do you make of the Obama administration's handling of the economy in this country?
They were given the worst deck of cards since 1929, and I think have done. They rescued America going into a 1929 crash, the economy seems to be pulling out. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, there are little bits and pieces that anyone would have done differently, but I think by and large, they made some big decisions that were necessary, like, you know, rescuing the car industry and rescuing the banks, which, if they hadn't done, I think we would have seen a 1929 crash. So I think they moved quickly and got on top of the problem.
Finally, let me ask you: you started from very little, a mail order record business back in the 70s. You're now a billionaire. Do you think it's harder these days to achieve that kind of success?
I don't think it's harder to achieve success today than it was when we started. If you have an idea where it's going to make a big difference to other people's lives, and other people are not doing it, just say screw it, just do it and get on with it and give it a go. Even if you fall flat in your face, you'll learn so much from it and have a lot of fun, and then you can pick yourself up and try again. So I think especially with the internet, there's just so many opportunities out there today.
Do you ever get bored with everyday life after all the thrills that you've had?
I think I'd be a very, very, very sad person if I ever said I got bored with everyday life. I have the richest, most fascinating experience and learning every single minute of every single day and loving every minute of it.
Sir Richard Branson is chairman of the Virgin Group. Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much. Cheers.
On Sunday, it's 20 years since riots erupted in South Los Angeles over the Rodney King verdict. And by the time the smoke had cleared, the cost and property damage and stuff looted from shops was as high as $1 billion. This in sprawling, low-income black and Hispanic neighborhoods that could ill afford it.
The American dream is shaking right now.
Top 1%.
I think we're very blessed to have what we have.
The 99%.
I've never been one to look for a handout.
For the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman introduces us to one woman who decided to deepen her economic roots in the neighborhood after the unrest.
South L.A. has seen some rebuilding, but little economic recovery since the riots. Unemployment is still high, incomes are low, foreclosures have soared. And there's black flight. 80,000 African Americans have moved out, many to suburbs where jobs, housing, and schools are better. Some in the middle class hang on. Bernadette Moore is 57. She's had the Total Woman Hair Salon here on noisy and kind of run-down Vernon Boulevard since 1989.
Hi. Well, this is my little humble abode. Let me show you around. It's just a little neighborhood shop.
Which attracts neighborhood women and also some who've left and come back to have Moore do their hair.
I don't do a lot of weaves. I just like to do like a lot of professional looks and keep the hair healthy.
The salon is in a little pink bungalow behind one of several rental properties that Moore's family has owned for decades.
It's in our community. I'm able to watch out and collect the rents, and it's just more convenient to be here.
A lot of African American families, when they're successful, move out. You didn't.
Right. And like, I have a sister, and you know, she's professional. She hasn't moved out either. My niece has moved out. She's in New York. I just believe in our community. I don't believe that just because you see a problem that you should run from it.
And what is your memory of that moment, 92, when the riots were happening? I mean, was this business affected directly?
No, actually, it really wasn't. You know, I lived through not only that riot, but the Watts riot. I mean, it was hard to see the neighborhood, you know, just what was going on, but we had to keep it moving, you know. We just had to keep it moving.
Right. Moore is keeping her business moving. She just opened a counseling and life coaching office nearby. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now, one more thing about that interview that Kai did with Secretary Tim Geithner. We've got Megan Larson, who produced the interview, here with us for a special second midday extra. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Jeremy.
So tell us, first of all, what Mr. Geithner was like.
You know, I have to say that, I mean, obviously, he's a very serious, straight-laced guy. He is a huge player in the global economy. But in the few moments, very brief moments that Kai had before the mic was in front of him and after, they were very relaxed. They were talking about, you know, living abroad, growing up in China, because as you probably know, Timothy Geithner, as a youngster, spent a lot of time overseas. His dad was in development. So he just seemed really kind of like he was enjoying the conversation.
Regular guy.
And then once the tape starts rolling, obviously he sits up, leans into Kai, and gets pretty serious. But when you think about it, his words could be potentially very dangerous. The guy has to be careful.
But it is true. Just about every time a Treasury Secretary faces a member of the news media, it's sort of a game of chicken. In other words, can you get the guy to say something that moves markets? And the Treasury Secretary working very hard not to say anything that actually moves markets inadvertently.
Yeah, it really is on, you know, us and the media to it's all about how we ask it, right? To try to get, try to elicit something new and interesting, or perhaps maybe the same information just said in a lighter way or a more emotional way. And we were really trying to draw his, you know, his thoughts, not the talking points, but that, you know, everybody's out there to provide, but really his thoughts about the economy, his thoughts on when he thinks about the people who don't feel the growth, don't feel the improvements. And, you know, we pushed him on Europe. I mean, he was very careful with his words, saying relatively comfortable, you know, about China. It was like, I think things are getting better. But we pushed back of like, relatively comfortable? Come on.
And of course, that's what we heard earlier in the podcast. And he came back and finally made a bit more of a definitive statement.
Where'd you do the interview? It was not in Washington.
No. We actually traveled up to San Francisco. He was on a very brief West Coast tour. He headed to Portland. Then he was in San Francisco doing a speech for the Commonwealth Club. And then I think he was headed back next week. I believe he goes to China. And, you know, gray, rainy day, but it gave way
typical
to sunshine.
San Francisco day.
Yeah.
Megan, you wrote something on our website about his handwriting, Secretary Geithner's handwriting.
I did, with the help of, you know, our webmasters, too. No, it was one of those funny things. We sort of got wind. If you look at his signature on the dollar bill, it is very clear, Timothy F. Geithner. But we found some former samples, which you can find online, and it's very, like, big and bubbly, and you really can't make up what's in there. Hmm. And so we had to ask him how he went from, like, the bubbles to, you know, this very, you know, Kai called it chicken scratch because Kai actually liked the bubbles. He thought that that was cool looking. But really, it comes down to the fact that you got to be able to read the guy's name who writes his name on a dollar.
What was the story behind the change?
Oh, well, you know what? Well, he had to actually go through some training. I mean, they're like, if you're going to have your name on the dollar bill, we need to be able to read it. And you couldn't read Tim Geithner. And, you know, a cute little story on sort of where he learned how to write his name. So,
well, Megan Larson, producer of the Marketplace Evening Show with Kai Rizdell, thanks a lot. We look forward to listening to the full interview tonight.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Jeremy.
And finally, did you know Google has created a device that lets you text, talk on the cell phone, apply makeup, and play Sudoku all while you drive to work, Jeremy?
I did not know that. Finally.
Yeah, well, I'm actually talking about that self-driving car they've been testing. The market research company J.D. Powers has been asking drivers about their interest in paying for self-driving technology, like radars that keep you automatically separated from the car in front of you, or a system that practically parallel parks the car by itself. About a third of consumers would be willing to pay about $3,000 extra for that kind of technology. P.S., for the first time, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood called for a federal law to ban cell phones and texting while driving. He calls it a, quote, national epidemic.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio, New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.